So we'll start already. Okay, good afternoon. I'll call to order the meeting of the State Government Budget Division for Monday, March 12, 2007. We do not yet have a quorum, but given the time constraints, I do have to get the committee going. Senator Jungbauer, could you chair? I'm going to present Senate File 131, and then we'll get the authors in here. So.
40 minutes.
Senator Betzold, Senate File 131.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. And first, let me explain, and we'll probably have to explain this again. As you go through your packets today, you will notice bills as they were introduced, plus you'll find some committee reports. Just because of the rush of the deadlines as they are right now, we were not able to get engrossed copies of some of the bills here. So in my case, Senate File 131, see the bill as it was introduced, but disregard that because there is a committee report signed by Senator Rest that was a delete-all amendment, and that's what we were actually working off of. So you do not have, as I say, an engrossed copy, but this is what the bill would read like if we had an engrossed copy. Mr. Chair, members, this bill did have some discussion last Friday in the State and Local Government Operations and Oversight Committee. This deals with the issue of electronic documents and how to create them, maintain them, preserve them down the road because of the changing technologies that we have. There's an issue called open format documents, and you will not see that word anywhere in this particular bill as it reads now. What the bill right now is simply a study, and the bill is a study on for the Chief Information Officer. That is the Office of Enterprise Technology. They will review electronic data, hardware, and software to determine how information documents are being created and maintained and preserved, and then they will report their findings back next January. This is an important issue as I said, because the technology is changing, we need to know what we're able to preserve and what we can share with other agencies and so forth. But because it's only a study, and because we are not presuming a particular outcome, I think that the stakeholders are okay with the language as it is, and they seem to be so as it left the policy committee last Friday. I don't know if anybody, and I don't know if there's a fiscal impact at all on this one because there is no fiscal note on this. But I do stand for any questions, and I don't know if anybody else is here to testify on the bill either, Mr. Chair.
Senator Rest.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Betzold, if there is no fiscal note, did you want this bill to travel on its own, or do you want to keep it in the State Government Finance
Bill? Mr. Chair, Senator Rest, I think the prudent thing for me to do would be to probably include it in the omnibus budget bill. If I do find out that there is a fiscal note, I'm going to have to deal with that at some point. If I send it on its own, find out that there's a fiscal note, then I got a problem. So. There is no fiscal note right, fiscal issue right now. I might find out that there will be. So I will move that Senate File, if there's nobody here and no opposition to it, I'll move that Senate File 131 be included in the omnibus budget bill.
Period. Yes.
We have a quorum?
Do I have a quorum yet?
We
no.
Don't.
We
don't
have
a quorum.
We just do now.
Let the record reflect we now have a quorum.
Renew your motion.
So, Senator Betzold, if you'd like to renew your motion, yes. Now that we have a quorum.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Betzold, there was a request for an amendment that came in. It's being drafted right now. I think it was from your office. Minor changes, but I don't have it available right now.
Okay. You don't have it. Okay. Well, I'll lay it over, Mr. Chair, and we'll deal with it when the amendment's available then. So.
Thank you, Senator Betzold.
And with that, we will. Who's the other? Senator Pappas? I guess you're the only other author in the room, is that?
That's in the room.
Is anybody else here other than Senator Larson's not here, Senator Higgins is not here, Torres Ray? So I guess Senator Pappas, you'd be the next bill.
Yep, good job.
Wait, what am I doing?
1369.
This is Senate File 1369, Domestic Partner Health Insurance Eligibility, and this also had a rather extensive hearing last Friday in the State and Local Government Operations and Oversight Committee. Senator Pappas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What the legislation would do is it would extend health insurance benefits to the domestic partners of state employees. Similar to a negotiated agreement that had been made in what the year was, I think 2001, and then was in effect at the request of then Governor Ventura for about 6 months, and then if you recall, the legislature had to confirm the agreement, and there was the House leadership that point, and then Governor Pawlenty said he would veto the legislation if this was included, so it was removed. So we're here to try again to say that Senate File 1369 should treat the partners of our employees who happen to be gay or lesbian the same as we treat the spouses of married employees. You know, as we all know, the option is not there for them to become married, but certainly many of these people are in very, very long committed relationships. Another argument is that we do want to be competitive in the marketplace, and we have a number of large employers in the state of Minnesota that do include this benefit in as part of their more complete benefit package, and that is Medtronic, General Mills, Xcel Energy, hundreds of other employers in Minnesota, 3M, AT&T, Alliant Tech Systems, Barnes & Noble, Best Buy, Land O'Lakes, McDonald's, Microsoft, NCR Corporation, just goes on and on the number of corporations that are Fortune 500 companies, frankly. Then we also have a large number of state governments that offer these benefits, 1, 2, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 13 other states, and then we have dozens of city governments that also offer these benefits, and county governments from around the country, and school districts as well. So it's just becoming much more in the mainstream. MAPE supports the legislation, as does AFSCME, and I would just urge that this bill be included in the omnibus bill. And were you taking testimony, too?
Yes, Senator Pappas. Again, although there was extensive testimony last week, I recognize that not all members of this budget division are on the policy committee. And I did, so I will entertain some very brief testimony, maybe up to 5 minutes each. I have two individuals who wish to testify. I believe one in support, one in opposition, so I'll give them that leeway, again, to bring members of the Budget Division up to speed. So, Mr. Cooper, I guess you indicated a desire to testify, and I guess, is Mr. Pritchard here? Yes, okay, then after him, Mr. Pritchard is indicated. Okay. Welcome to the Budget Division. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Scott Cooper. I'm with Outfront Minnesota. I'm here to speak in favor of the bill. Thank Senator Pappas for carrying this legislation, and thank you for your time in hearing it. Mr. Chair, as you said, we did have extensive testimony in the policy committee on this subject, so we'll try to keep it brief here. Our main points are that this is simply the fair thing to do for state employees. It is good business for the state, and it is fairly simple to accomplish. It is fair because currently, as you know, health insurance and other types of benefits, aside from your salary, are a significant part of your benefits package. They're, especially with healthcare costs going up, they're an increasingly large part of your benefits package. And currently we have state employees who sit in, who do not have access to healthcare coverage for their significant other, who sit next to employees who do have that opportunity to get health insurance for their spouses. And that's simply not fair. We had testimony from some state employees and former state employees about their feelings on this in the policy committee. So we think it's simply a matter of fairness. It's good business for the state because it allows you to be competitive in attracting and retaining the best employees. This is a very common practice in the private sector in Minnesota. As Senator Pappas mentioned, there are over 300, and I think it is 350 now, large private sector employers in Minnesota that offer domestic partner benefits. They're not doing it because it's the kind-hearted thing to do. They're doing it because it's good business. It allows them to attract and retain the best employees. We think that the state should be able to do the same thing. We believe that this is an easy thing to accomplish because it's been done before and is currently being done by not only all those private sector employers that we've mentioned, but also by other states, by counties and cities and school districts across the country. Here in Minnesota, we have experience with it in the public sector because the city of Minneapolis offered these benefits for years in the early 90s. And so we have experience with the administration of it and what the potential costs are. And because the state of Minnesota offered these benefits, as Senator Pappas mentioned, several years ago for a little over a year. And the cost at that time was found to be less than $200,000 a year. And much of that, of course, came from the payments of premiums of the state employees. So for those reasons, we hope that you will consider supporting this and including it in the state omnibus funding bill. I think Senator Pappas mentioned that we have the support of the major public employees unions. And I would like to say that they and we believe that the best way to have gone about this to begin with would have been to go through the collective bargaining process and have this included in contracts. We tried to do that several years ago. It was in the contracts as they were negotiated between the Ventura administration and the public employees unions. And unfortunately, the leadership in the House at the time said that they would not accept those contracts with that in it. And then Majority Leader Pawlenty said that this was not a matter for collective bargaining, that it was a major policy issue that should be decided by the legislature, and it should not come from the governor's office, and that Governor Ventura had overstepped his bounds. So we are taking that advice, and we are bringing it to the legislature for your consideration. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator John Barr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess I just have one concern I'd like to have addressed here, and I don't know if Senator Pappas or who the best to address this is. Let's just say for a moment that you could convince me that this is a good thing for business. What I'm a little concerned with, by enacting this legislation, I think Minnesota kind of puts itself up for potential litigation and then using this kind of legislation as a backdoor into an approval of same-sex marriage by the court system. Would there be any way to, if we all agreed that it was a good thing for business, would there be any way to put into legislation some protection there from the courts being able to use this for an imposition of same-sex marriage?
Who wishes to address that? Mr. Cooper?
I'd be happy to try to address that. I'm not an attorney, so I'm not giving any sort of legal advice here. But my understanding is that in the states where there have been lawsuits related to marriage, the court decisions have been that the states were required to either create an institution like marriage or to give equal benefits to their citizens. I think that an effort to create some sort of fairness in the area of employment is far short of either of those things, is a very small step. It's what we're asking for here. We're not asking for marriage. Marriage is not part of this, and not contemplated in this in any way. But I do think that taking a step toward creating equality for your employees is actually moving in the direction of what those courts asked for. And so I think that it would not increase your risk and your openness to lawsuit, but would in fact decrease it because you're showing that you're trying to not discriminate against your employees.
Other questions? Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Pappas or Mr. Cooper, on line 121, it says if one domestic partner temporarily leaves the common residence, what would your description of temporary be?
Takes a trip. Mr. Chairman, Senator Roebling. I think takes a trip, or it could be, has a temporary job out of town, travels with your job, and has to be out of the residence for a relatively short period of time, or goes to school for a few months. Sometimes, I know I got a Bush Fellow, and I went to Harvard for 4 months, but my residence was still Minnesota. I was just in school for a period of time. So that would be my definition. I don't know if anyone else has a different one. But you're still sharing a common residence. You're still contributing to the household in whatever way you can.
Good question. Senator Limmer.
Mr. Chair, Senator Pappas, I think Senator Roebling raises a pretty good question, and we don't want to have anything ambiguous here. On line 21 through 22 on page 1, if one domestic partner temporarily leaves the common residence, now you're just leaving an address, but with the intention to return, these benefits can continue. And you know, temporary for some people in your example is 4 months, but would 4 years be temporary? 14 years be temporary? What is temporary? And all the qualifying factor is that they just have to state or reflect the intent to return. So I don't even think other health insurance benefits are even written with this wide of a berth for coverage. So this seems like you could go indefinitely, and if anyone asks, say, "Oh, I intend to get back there." See what I'm saying? It's kind of a wide open opportunity. The partnership could dissolve, but it doesn't say anything about the partnership dissolving. It's just leaving the common residence. So they can change the address. Maybe the two people don't even want to be with each other. But in this case, the qualifying factor is leaves the common residence, one, and two, with some type of intent to return. To me, that just seems like it's just an indefinite, it could be read very easily as an indefinite thing, as long as you don't want to move back to the common residence and you don't have it, and you have every intention of returning.
Mr. Senator Chairman, Pappas. I gave my answer to Senator Roebling. Maybe Mr. Cooper would like to try.
Mr. Chair, Senator Limmer, we're certainly open to other ways of defining this if you have suggestions. Our intention here was to define it as narrowly as reasonably possible and still make it usable for people. Certainly, if a state employee includes their spouse on their health insurance, there's no provision that prevents them from living apart forever and still remaining spouses and having that person on their health insurance. So we were trying to make it clear that this was intended to be for people who live together but still leave the leeway for people who may, for the circumstances Senator Pappas mentioned, be apart for some period of time and yet haven't ended their relationship. We're certainly open to suggestions.
Mr. Chair, this is the first time I've seen the bill, and this is the first committee I've had an opportunity to look at it. I'm not an author on it. I usually let authors fix up their own bills, but I don't have any suggestion right now. I'm just pointing out that this could be really written. This is written as if it's open-ended, and unfortunately, I don't have the means to fix your bill.
Mr. Chair, Senator Limmer, the intention is also that the administration of this through the Department of Employee Relations or whoever else administers it would narrow this down in their administration. That is certainly what happened under the Ventura administration. The Department of Employee Relations created forms. They had a form you had to sign where you swore that you were the domestic partner. You would have been committing fraud if you signed that for the purpose of getting health insurance for someone who was not really your domestic partner. They also required that certain documents be shown. A joint checking account was one example. You had to prove that you lived together. And that was done by the Department of Employer Relations as they would create forms to administer any other benefit. So I'm assuming that under the guidelines you set forth here in the statute, they would do the same thing and try and lock it down a little bit more.
Senator Jungbauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I guess kind of gearing off of what Senator Limmer said, lines 1.17 through 1.23, it seems like this specifically speaks to that there would create a new area in law in terms of there is no mutual responsibility like you would see in a married couple. They're mutually responsible for their household and other properties in terms of joint ownership and stuff. And I guess that kind of concerns me that we've defined it without responsibility that would occur in other employees that we do offer the health benefits to. So I'm a little concerned about that kind of a language.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Pappas.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Gensbauer, I just want to point out line 1112 that they have to agree that they're responsible for each other's basic common welfare. So there has to have been a commitment there. I also want to mention a couple other things that when we did experiment with this for, it was under a year in 2001, 2003, out of 50,000 state employees, 85 asked for health care coverage for their domestic partners. And the cost of that was, you know, under $200,000. It was very small. It wasn't a huge impact. And part of the reason why that might have happened is that there's actually some tax consequences. Domestic partner benefits, unlike spousal benefits, are considered imputed income by the IRS and are taxed. So employees who sign their partners up for benefits incur a large tax penalty. So the people that also, you know, we may not like it, but it's the federal law right now, so that may have also slow down the number of people who sign up for it. It tends to be people who, you know, really have no other option, and that this becomes very important enough to bear the additional tax burden.
Are there other questions, Mr. Cooper? If not, then we will hear from Mr. Pritchard. We had about 5 minutes of testimony and a bit more than that of questions, so we'll try to balance it out there. Welcome to the Budget Division. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Tom Pritchard, President of the Minnesota Family Council, and we're here to speak in opposition to this bill. We have a number of reasons why you oppose it and believe it's not a wise use of taxpayer dollars. First of all, we believe it contradicts or conflicts with state marriage law and the policy behind that, which we believe will only serve to weaken and destabilize marriage even more. And the reason we believe it contradicts is basically you're setting up a relationship or a status which is pretty much identical to marriage except for the fact that it's same-sex individuals. And so we see this as kind of an indirect way to move towards same-sex marriage and providing marriage benefits to same-sex couples. Another concern, we believe that this law or this proposal is discriminatory and unfair. First of all, to families or married couples to begin with. The domestic partners would be receiving the same benefits as married couples, except they wouldn't have the legal duty to care, which already exists for married couples. So you're giving people who don't have an underlying legal duty to care for one another a benefit which married couples do not have. In addition, we believe it's unfair and discriminatory towards other family members. Let's say an individual is caring for their elderly parent, or they're caring for a disabled adult child, or an adult sibling. So in a sense, those people are cut out, and if the goal here is to really care for additional people, this proposal is in fact discriminatory and unfair. There's also the question as to whether this conflicts with states' anti-discrimination laws regarding employment, because you're giving a benefit to some people but not other similarly situated people. And then the issue of competitiveness. It's been argued that this is needed to make the state more competitive. Well, I think the state really wants to increase its benefits or to attract other employees, why would it target it less than maybe one-half of 1%? It was already pointed out that 85 individuals under the previous plan sought this benefit. Why would the state be targeting recruitment for such a narrow range of people? And we believe that if the state really wants to be competitive, it should have a broader range of benefits. And finally, we believe that this will open the door to potential lawsuits against the state of Minnesota in terms of its marriage laws. Massachusetts, Vermont, New Jersey have had their marriage laws overturned, and in the court opinions, they've cited the presence of domestic partner benefit situations as a basis for overturning those state marriage laws. So we're seeing that this is opening the door potentially to a challenge of our state marriage laws. And for those reasons, we oppose this legislation. I also have copies of testimony that Jordan Lawrence, who's with an organization called the Alliance Defense Fund, made at the last hearing but couldn't be here today. So I'll just leave those here as well. So
we'll have that distributed right now.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Are there any questions, Mr. Pritchard? Senator Olstein.
Mr. Pritchard, I know you had mentioned that you thought this might lead to the breakdown of marriage. What's the divorce rate in this country?
I don't know specifically. I think it's maybe 30-40%. It could be that high.
I actually hear numbers of 50%, and so I'm a little concerned that you're concentrating your efforts on less than 0.5% of state employees when it seems like there's a marriage crisis out there. And I can understand that you see this as an issue, but to me there seems a much bigger issue that you might concentrate your time on. But I do appreciate your positions. I guess that's all I really have.
Mr. Pritchard.
Mr. Chair, Senator Olsen, a couple comments. Yeah, we believe marriage is in a state of crisis, and the divorce rate is far too high, and we'd be glad to work with you, and we're working on some legislation now that would reexamine our no-fault divorce laws, which we think has contributed to the breakdown of marriage and destabilizing it. Our view is, though, same-sex marriage basically doesn't just allow a few other individuals to, quote, marry, but it redefines the fundamental institution. And that has repercussions far beyond the few same-sex couples who would, under that situation, be able to marry, because it would eliminate, and we see this in other states, in terms of the discussion of marriage, you eliminate the notion of a mother and a father in the life of young children, and that's the chief benefit, I think, in understanding of marriage, of why the state's interested is the importance of providing a stable environment for raising children. And when you eliminate the notion of a mother and a father, I think that will serve to destabilize marriage even further. So clearly we've got a crisis with divorce rates, but also I think you redefine marriage, it's only further destabilizing marriage.
Senator Pappas? Or?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'm really not here to discuss marriage with the committee. I'm just here with a proposal to treat our gay and lesbian employees equally so that their partners can also have access to health insurance that our heterosexual employees have access to.
Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've heard a little discussion about the cost of the proposal, but I don't see a fiscal note, and I'm wondering, I am assuming because it's in our finance division that there must be a fiscal cost to it, and especially if it's going to be considered for the omnibus bill. So do we have something?
I was going to ask that question. A lot of things have come to the Finance Committee, and fiscal notes are not available yet, but if there was a question as to whether there might be a cost, that's why it gets sent. Mr. Lindeen, do you have any analysis here?
Yes, there are actually, I think most of the bills we're going to hear today just came out of the policy committee. So there are fiscal note requests in, but there wasn't enough time to get them turned around for the committee. the likely cost to this one would be in the CGIP, the State Employee Insurance Group Fund. And it would probably, I think Senator Pappas said something about there was a $200,000 or less than that the last time this was in effect. And that would be an impact to the CGIP fund, which is funded through the premiums from the employer and the employees that are requesting the coverage.
So would that affect the budget targets that we are putting together here? I mean, that might be an impact to the insurance fund, but we have to set a budget based upon the base and, you know, our target, which is a negative number. Does that affect our numbers?
It would not affect our general fund numbers. It would be, the costs of this would be spread across all of state government, all employees, and all state agencies coming out of their operating funds.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Roebling.
I would think that it would affect the state in the sense that we are the employers who contribute to the insurance benefit. And so there has to be a cost to the state as well, because there is a significant buy down for family coverage for our state employees.
And Senator Roebling, you may be correct. Again, without a fiscal note, we're kind of at a loss here. It's just as we had on my bill a moment ago. If the bill were to travel on its own and have a fiscal impact, we'd have to bring it back to the Finance Committee. If it were to be rolled into the omnibus bill and we find out that there's a cost in there that's not covered, then we'd have to find a way to cover it. If it doesn't travel, then we don't have to worry about that. So that's kind of the disadvantage we're at trying to put together the bill at this particular stage, and we don't quite have some of these numbers nailed down, but that appears to be the best guess.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Limmer.
Mr. Chair, when we consider bills, is it the function of our committee to analyze the cost implications, or is that the Finance Committee, or is it both?
Well, Senator Limmer, this is a budget division, and we have oversight over approximately $550 million of the state budget within our area, and to that extent, we're going to be making recommendations to the Finance Committee and ultimately to the full Senate as to what ought to happen within the area that we have oversight with. To the extent that we are adding programs or spending money, we have to justify it within the targets that we are given. We can't spend more than we've been assigned to, and as I indicated last Friday, and as we'll be discussing later on after we finish these bills, our division was given a negative number, that is negative $10 million, which we'll be able to address, but we can't exceed the target that we've been given. Sarah Pappas.
Mr. Chairman, I just wanted to say that it's very difficult to predict this. You don't know how many people are going to sign up for it, and in any one year, state employees may be changing their benefit set. For example, my husband got a new job a couple years ago and considered dropping dependent care because we don't have any children at home yet anymore, and going with the health insurance for his new employer. So, I mean, I'm sure there are things like that happening all the time. It's kind of a moving target. So that's why it's very difficult to get fiscal notes on things like this that has such a small, minimal impact.
No, Mr. Chair.
Sarah Limmer.
Mr. Chair, Senator Pappas, I don't know if it's such a minimal cost. I don't know how anyone would be able to determine whether it's a minimum cost or not. One doesn't know the health impact of a narrow population of people that would be added to the state employee benefit roll. And so I don't know how we as a committee can make a judgment when you don't have the numbers on your bill. Your bill has been around for a while. I don't know how long, but I would imagine that someone has asked the question, how much would it cost? And now we're in front of the Finance Committee and no one knows. And now we're expected to make a vote on it?
No.
I'm not sure what we're doing.
Well, this bill does, this is not the Finance Committee, of course. It's the Budget Division. This bill, the budget bill, or any individual bill would go before the Finance Committee from here, which takes it out of the hands of this Budget Division. But at some point, if this were to be rolled into the omnibus bill, if there's a fiscal note that can't, for any item that cannot be paid for, then we can't do it. But I don't know. I don't have a fiscal note here, so. Sarah Pappas or anybody?
Mr. Chairman, just one final comment. I can say this again. I already said this, but I think we do have some information, which is better than none information, in that we had this benefit from between 6 months to a year between 2001 and 2003, and the cost of the state was under $200,000. Of the 50,000 state employees, 85 asked for health care coverage for their domestic partners. So we have that in our experience, I think, to go by, and because of the tax consequences, I can't, we don't know that it would be any different than that, significantly.
And let me just note, and I've, for Senator Pappas and the other members, I did vote for this proposal last Friday when it was before the Policy Committee. However, I have told the advocates, as I said, if there's a cost in here, we may not be able to do it. And that's just like every other thing we're going to be looking at. So, and I don't know what the cost is right now. Senator Limmer.
With all due respect to Senator Pappas and the committee, I would suggest we temporarily lay it on the table until we have a fiscal note in front of us. I'd like to put that in the form.
Well, motion to table is non-debatable.
Temporary motion to it.
Well, whether it's temporarily or however it is, a motion to table is non-debatable. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say no.
No.
No. No.
The motion does not prevail. Further discussion on Senate File 1346.
Roll call, Mr. Chair.
Roll call on the bill. Well, there's no motion right now. Is there a motion, Senator Pappas?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I would move that 1369 be incorporated into the omnibus bill or laid over for inclusion in the omnibus bill?
Well, based upon what Mr. Lundeen said, he believes apparently that there is no direct cost to the targets, but there may be cost to the insurance. So if you wanted to make a motion to put it in the bill, I think that we could address that. But as I indicated, if by the time it gets to the Finance Committee or even to the floor, if there is a fiscal note that shows a cost, I may have a problem with this being in the bill. So, but if you want to make a motion to put it in, you may do that. If you want to lay it over, we're going to be discussing that probably not today, but on Wednesday as to put it in. But you could make a motion now to put it in the bill if you chose to do
Mr.
so.
Mr. Chairman, then I'd move that Senate File 1369 be incorporated into the omnibus bill.
Okay.
Roll call, Mr.
And Senator Limmer has asked for a roll call vote. Is there discussion on the motion? There appears to be none. Okay, the Secretary will take the roll then.
Senator Betzold.
Yes.
Senator Jung Bauer.
No.
Senator Kubley.
Yes.
Senator Larson.
Yes.
Senator Limmer?
No.
Senator Olsen?
Yes.
Senator Pappas?
Yes.
Senator Rust? Yes. Senator Roebling?
No.
On a vote of 6-3, the motion prevails. Okay, so we are done with this bill for the moment. Thank you, Senator Pappas. For individuals who are here on my bill, Senate File 131, there is an A2 amendment. I'll have it made available. I won't take it up at this moment. I'll have it distributed and put down there. I'm told that there is no problem with it, but if anybody has a problem, please let us know because things are going to be moving quickly here. Also, members, in your packets, there's Senate File 1081. That was put on the agenda. The bill was put in your packets. But the bill was sent to the Rules Committee, so it is not before us today. So if you find 1081 in your packets, please disregard it. Also, again, for members who came in since the start of the meeting, because of the pace at which the legislative session is going right now, we do not have engrossed copies of all of our bills before us from the committee. So you will find, in many cases, the bill as introduced, plus possibly a committee report, rather than the gross version. So you may have to look at both documents in order to figure out what is properly before us. Is Senator Higgins here yet? Because she's not on the budget division. I don't see her. So, Senator Larson, would you be prepared right now for Senate File 1297?
Yes.
Okay. Senate File 1297, automatic voter registration of driver's license, permit, and identification card applicants. And again, all these bills were heard previously in the policy committee, so we just need to kind of get a quick overview as to what they do for members who are not on that committee, and then a look at the fiscal note. There's something being passed out right now. I'd say there's a fiscal note request worksheet, which is not exactly a fiscal note, but Mr. Lundeen, could you explain what is being passed out right now?
Yes, as I mentioned earlier, with the turnaround of the bills coming out of the policy committee and the fiscal note requests, there wasn't time to get the formal fiscal notes that have been signed off by the Department of Finance, but I did have some discussions with the Secretary of State's office because a number of the bills that we'll be hearing, the next few bills, will be impacting the Secretary of State's office, and they have provided us their kind of worksheet and their, you know, taking a look at the bills and their take at looking at a fiscal note. I mean, the one caveat I have to add is the Department of Finance has not, you know, looked at this information and signed off on it. This is coming solely from the Secretary of State's office.
Senator Larson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Senate File 1297 is Secretary of State Mark Ritchie's automatic voter registration legislation, and I have Secretary of State Mark Ritchie with us here to testify and present his legislation that essentially, members, does many of the things, and actually I think rather than be seen as greatly changes our voter registration process, it actually is an attempt to improve upon our current voter registration process. Currently, we have the opportunity when we sign up for our driver's license to opt in to voter register at that time. This bill actually takes us from opt-in to opt-out, and so you will automatically be registered, but it would give you the opportunity at that application to decide not to be registered if you so chose. In addition, the general effect, I think, of this legislation will be to reduce same-day registrations, providing for efficiencies for our local units of government and greater ease on election day, especially for our local election officials. And will also be greatly convenient for voters who may find themselves moving from time to time, will allow us to have them be registered and keep them registered as long as we can verify their residence. Also believe, Mr. Chair and members, that this bill will also improve our the security of our state voter registration system. With that, I will turn it over to Secretary Ritchie and look forward to the discussion.
Mr. Secretary, welcome to the Budget Division. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mark Ritchie, Secretary of State. Thank you, Senator Larson. The fiscal note worksheet indicates two primary areas of expenses. One of them is to do the initial changing to our computer programming, which will allow us to go from our current system, which is we're communicating electronically with the Department of Public Safety once a week, gathering some information. We have to expand our system to be able to communicate on a daily basis and also to be able to work electronically with the judiciary because, of course, we have to make sure that everybody meets not only the age and citizenship requirements, but also the question about whether someone is a felon or not, or perhaps through some other order of the court, through incompetence or some other guardianship procedure, has lost the right to vote. And then the ongoing expense is the cost each year to be directly linked electronically with the U.S. Postal Service's automatic change of address system. We found that there were two major types of registrations going on for Election Day, on Election Day. The largest was the change of address, so we would be spending a small amount of money, $15,000 each year, to be connected through a vendor to the U.S. Postal Service, so we would get automatic address changes. The estimate given to us by the counties is that this procedure would save about $1 million an election cycle. A large portion of that is in the cost of extra poll workers, and the other part of that is in the savings in post-election day data entry. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Are there any questions? And again, this is to be, you have to opt out. It's going to happen automatically. Senator Limmer.
Mr. Chair, did we have a fiscal note on this?
Well,
there's some empty line items on that.
We don't have a formal. Could you go explain again?
Oh, yeah. I guess there is one.
Yeah, we have a worksheet here from the Secretary of State's office. So this is reflecting all of the costs that the Secretary of State sees to their office. There may be costs to, you know, some other agencies. For example, I know there's dealing with getting some information from the Commissioner of Public Safety. So there may be a cost to public safety, which is not going to be reflected in this worksheet.
So there is a cost here. Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Secretary of State Ritchie. I like the idea of what you're trying to accomplish here. I guess my biggest question is, it's only my second term, and we always talk about how, well, especially in this committee now, interoperability, one computer in the state being able to talk to another one, and in terms of public safety, we've talked about not being able to access records, and this whole idea requires us to be able to get an awful lot of information from an awful lot of different sources in order to be able to back this all up. Can you kind of speak to that and quell my fears on not being able to find all that information?
Secretary Ritchie.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Senator John Bauer. I can only say two things, and I hope that they can address some of your fears. These are my concerns because I have to ultimately certify that this is successful. The first is that we are now dealing with the two major agencies, Department of Public Safety and the Judiciary, more or less on a weekly basis. And we've been building that relationship. I feel very good about it. And, of course, we're talking about expanding it and making it daily. And, you know, so there's the changes that way. But I think it's been a challenge to both those agencies and to ours to build this relationship, and so far so good. But the second thing, and I want to expand on this slightly, we're working very directly with the Office of Enterprise Technology, which is the system-wide. In fact, we signed an agreement on Friday. They're doing analysis of our agency to see how part of our IT, some or all, might fit into the overall statewide. But one of the reasons why I've chosen to work with them very directly is that we see down the road many more opportunities for integration, and looking forward, if the federal government actually imposes the real ID requirement, which is the federal law on the driver's license, my colleague in Michigan, the Secretary of State in Michigan, has imagined a proposal where an enhanced driver's license could be used as a passport in relationship to going to and from Canada and to and from Mexico. And, of course, for Minnesotans, soon to be required to have actual passports to be able to go across to fish, her proposal one is one very interesting to me. So I'm looking towards a very robust growth in our relationships of interoperability, and I want that statewide Office of Enterprise Technology to be a really key partner. This proposal is about expanding a current relationship, you know, and making it more frequent and more robust. But I'm looking long-term because I believe we are going to be in an era where greater interoperability is going to be important for a variety of things, this just being one of them.
Senator Zogbauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and again, Secretary Ritchie. I guess it really didn't get to the heart of whether we're there yet. Would it be, are we, you know, by trying to implement this today, are we kind of putting the cart before the horse? Could we try it in one county and see if we're up to speed there before we would try it statewide? It just seems like a wonderful idea whose time might not quite be right. I don't know.
Secretary Ritchie.
Mr. Chairman, Senator John Bauer, we now are doing this, and every week we do this successfully, so we don't have any fears about being able to do it, you know, every day as opposed to every week. Trying it in one county, it's a statewide system, and so our felony registrations and that kinds of things are basically statewide system, and people move. So I would fear that we might miss somebody if we were doing it on a county. Let's take a big county or maybe two big counties. If people moved around, then I feel like we wouldn't catch them. We registered these folks on Election Day. I mean, that's the thing. So this basically is moving the work from post-election to pre-election, which then gives us the benefit of being able to really check their citizenship, really check their felony status. So I feel like the real benefits come from moving the system into a more – this proposal would move us to a more secure system, and I feel a lot of confidence in our ability to do that. But again, the proposal also requires that I ultimately feel comfortable and certify that the system is fully operating before it would be implemented. So ultimately, it would be my responsibility to say yes. All elements of it are ready to go. We're going to try it.
Other questions? Senator Limmer?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Secretary Ritchie, if I could draw your attention to page 3, lines 312 and 313. This talks about some of the data that would be necessary in order to register someone for voting. And it talks about the voter's name on the driver's license, the address, date of birth. You've included citizenship and then later, of course, town and signature. But the one I'm focusing on is citizenship. Do we have on our driver's license a designation stating whether or not the holder of that driver's license is, in fact, a citizen or not?
Secretary Ritchie?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Lim. Yes, if you are not a permanent resident, you are a temporary visitor from another country, you're not a citizen. It says this on your driver's license. If you are a permanent resident, a permanent green card holder, the Department of Public Safety gathers that citizenship information, but does not print that on your driver's license. In fact, they gather quite a bit of citizenship information by law, and I don't know if it would be appropriate to hand around what Department of Public Safety does require, but they require citizenship information for new driver's licenses and learner's permits and IDs. And if you're here from another country, it says it on the bottom of your driver's license.
Sir Lover.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Secretary Ritchie, the citizenship that you're making reference to, I believe that's done by an executive order or an order by the DPS. I don't think that's a state statute. So if, let's say, an administration changed and they no longer wanted to include citizenship on driver licenses, what happens to this bill if it becomes law? Does that go away, the citizenship requirement reference, or would it still be in effect?
Secretary Ritchie.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Limmer, it's required by law in this law that they collect that information and provide it to us, and it's required by law that we certify that someone is of the proper age, citizenship requirement, felony, and guardianship requirement.
And Secretary Ritchie, you gave examples of whether or not someone had a legitimate visa, a green card. What if the individual is an illegal immigrant? Can they still get a driver's license in the state of Minnesota?
Secretary Ritchie.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Limmer, I'm assuming that people have broken laws and gotten driver's licenses, but generally speaking, they're not gotten through DPS. They're just produced in some backyard driver's license falsification. It's normally how young people get IDs for the purposes of buying alcohol or other purposes. So our job is making sure that they have citizenship papers. So this is normally a passport, a birth certificate, certified birth certificate, or some other. Our relationship with the Department of Public Safety make me feel very confident in their ability to really determine if people who are applying for driver's licenses are bringing in citizenship documents.
But presumably, if somebody has a counterfeit license, that's not going to be in the DPS database, I would think. So, Senator Limmer?
I don't know if you're changing residences and you're asking or showing your new driver's license in order to get an opportunity to be registered to vote. I'm not sure if these folks would be able to catch it unless it's a poor counterfeit.
Of course, I remember if somebody showed up today, without a change like this in law, and they've got a counterfeit driver's license, how would the people at the polls be able to catch it?
Yeah, that's the point I made.
Yeah.
Sure. Mr. Chairman, Senator Limmer, yeah, that's what's great about our proposal is that if somebody did register on election day and then we looked them up and they weren't on our system, but they had driver's license number, we would find them immediately. And so we would. This is what's great about this proposal in terms of being able to identify people who attempted to use false. But of course, voting illegally is a felony, and it will get you deported. And so very few felons and very few people who are in this country illegally because they're trying to work actually take that risk because the penalty for it is quite high.
Okay. Further discussion on Senate File 1297. Senator Larson, did you want to move the bill, lay it over for conclusion of the omnibus bill? As I could say, it's got a tentative fiscal note, so we have to put it aside.
Mr. Chair, I move that Senate File 1297 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
On that motion, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, say no. What's the bill? Thank you, Senator Larson. Senator Higgins, you have Senate File 1298, Miscellaneous Elections, Voter Registration, and Ballot Requirement Modifications. Senator Higgins, welcome to the Budget Division.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. 1298.
And there's fiscal note request worksheet coming around, members. Senator Higgins, if you could basically describe what the bill does, as I say, since this is the Budget Division, we'll need to look at the fiscal impacts of what your bill does. but you need to generally describe it for people who did not hear it on the policy committee.
Mr. Chair, is there a fiscal note for the bill?
Well, there is, and it's coming around now. The Secretary's, this was prepared by the Secretary of State's office. This is not the actual fiscal note, but it's kind of a worksheet to indicate what they think the impact is, which would be about $85,000 in 08, 942 in 09, well, 5 and 10, 971 and 11.
Okay.
Mr. Lundin?
Yeah. I also just want to add that I did have a call from the Office of Administrative Hearings this morning. They thought there may be some impact to them, and so they may want to speak to how this impacts their office.
And they're here to speak
yes.
as well. Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair and members, Senate File 1298 is a collection of provisions put together by the Secretary of State's office in an attempt to make various provisions alike from unit of government to unit of government. There have been times, for example, where the city candidates are treated differently from the state candidates, and part of this bill brings those into alignment. Otherwise, they're just kind of various provisions, some that I think that are interesting to me anyway. On the top of page 5, we prohibit people who do voter registration drives from paying the people who are out there collecting the signatures by the voter registration applicant or by the signature. We don't want anybody to get into the position of thinking that they can make an extra buck or two because they can photocopy somebody's application or otherwise fraudulently put a card in. So we just flat out say they can't excuse me pay by the number of voter registration applicants. And I think that might be interesting to some people. The things that have a fiscal impact in this bill, you will see on the top of page 2 in the thing that is fiscal note worksheet. Maybe Ms. Fraser is probably better at that since I think she helped prepare this. So I'll turn it over to Ms. Fraser from the Secretary of State's office.
Mr. Chair?
Welcome to the Budget Division. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Beth Fraser, the Director of Governmental Affairs for the Secretary of State's office. The provisions in this bill that have a fiscal impact are, as Senator Higgins said, outlined on page 2. Subdivision 4 allows for online voter registrations for people who have a Minnesota driver's license or state ID card. We believe that it would provide a service to voters, an easy way to update their registrations or to register for the first time, and limiting it to people with a driver's license or ID card means that they're already in a state system. We can easily match their driver's license or state ID card record, and DPS has their signature on file if that's needed. That piece would cost about $80,000 in programming. Section 8 provides a reminder to be sent to each voter in the state. This description says household, which was the bill is introduced, but it's been changed to voter in each registered voter in the previous committee. So basically, 7 weeks before the general election, we would mail a postcard to every voter in the state, letting them know where they're supposed to go vote. And this would serve as a way to clean up our database. The postcard would be non-forwardable. So if it's returned to the county, then we would know that there's some question about whether the person really lives there. Not only would this be a benefit to the rosters to make sure that they're as up-to-date as possible, It would also make our database more valuable to candidates, political parties, and other interest groups that use the data in getting out the vote or otherwise contacting voters. That provision is the most expensive provision in the bill and would cost just under $1 million, $935,000. Section 11 actually doesn't have a fiscal impact. It would allow candidates for state office to file for office either at the Secretary of State's office or at their county auditor's office. Currently, if your district goes over county lines, then you have to file at the Secretary of State's office. If it's fully contained in one county, then you have to file at your county office. And there was one candidate in the last election who was actually ultimately kicked off the ballot because his district was wholly contained in Hennepin County but filed at the Secretary of State's office. Okay. So we're just...
Yeah. Ms. Fraser, yes. we have a delete everything amendment. I don't think you're working off of that one. This is I don't know if you've got the bills introduced, or are you working off of the subcommittee or the committee report from Senator Rest? I don't know which one.
Oh, I'm sorry, these sections may not line up exactly, but the costs are.
Yeah. Well, here's the dilemma I've got right now, is that clearly there's part of this bill that has no cost.
Yes.
And this is a budget division, so we only need to look at the cost items. I think that what we're going to have to wind up doing is that the bill is actually in the Finance Committee. You know, we don't have bills in budget divisions. So I think that you're going to have to work with Senator Higgins to identify those non-cost items. And then Senator Higgins maybe asks Senator Cohen to bring up your bill in the Finance Committee, strip out anything that's got any budget impact, and then the bill could probably travel on its own. If it's got a budget impact, we have to deal with it here. But if it doesn't have any budget impact, you know, because otherwise, as I say, you know, if we can't fund something, we don't want your whole bill to go down simply because of some items we can't fund. So you probably want to identify. We don't need to spend any time in this division identifying things that don't have an impact. We need only to look at those things that do, but then get your bill out of finance, you know, talk to Senator Cohen and say, move it out of finance, strip out the fiscal issues. Then your bill can go ahead with the non-budget costs.
Okay, Mr. Chair.
Yeah. So have we covered the things that do have a fiscal cost here? We don't need to spend time on the non-fiscal.
Mr. Chair, that's what we were doing, was just talking about the ones that had the fiscal cost.
Okay.
We have two more provisions that have a cost, and it used to be Section 13. I'm not sure what number it is now. That would have the Secretary of State each month mail a voter registration information to each newly naturalized citizen, and giving him information on how to register to vote and how to serve as an election judge.
Section 21.
And then the provision, I think probably right after that, provides for a new complaint system similar to that enacted in conformance with the Help America Vote Act. The language that we had in statute was obsolete, and the language in this bill is more current with HAVA. Those last two provisions cost, the complaint one was $2,250, and the mailings to the naturalized citizens are about $9,300. Everything else, Mr. Chair, as far as I can tell, doesn't have a fiscal impact.
Let me pose a question, maybe Senate Counsel. If we were to have a motion to just forward the bill to the Finance Committee and direct Council to remove those items that have a fiscal impact, is that doable, or is that too complicated for this stage?
Mr. Chairman, I think it would be best to identify the particular sections and then delete everything. I don't think
Just
seems like there's some discretion involved there. That
yeah. Well, I don't.
The provision numbers are.
I don't know that we can do this at the moment, and we do have some other bills to get to. Ms. Fraser, would you be able to identify things that have clearly no fiscal impact and be ready in a few minutes to do that? Senator Higgins has another bill. We could lay this one over for a few minutes and have you do that. So could you identify the things, and do you have the committee report from Senator Rust dated March 9th, 2007?
Yes.
Okay. If you can work off of that and just be prepared to give us a list of the sections that have no fiscal impact, we can move it off. So I'm going to set this one aside for a few minutes. And then Senator Higgins, you have Senate File 954, voter registration provision modifications.
Mr. Chair, I do. And is there a fiscal note for this? I haven't seen it yet.
We also have a fiscal note request worksheet coming around, members.
Okay.
Senator Higgins.
Mr. Chair, these are some various provisions, mostly relating to election day registration and how, I suppose I could do the same thing if I could see what we have in here that costs money. We could just talk about the things that cost money. I'm sorry.
Well, this is, let's see, how many sections? It looks like it's four sections, so I'm not quite sure what that would be, so.
Have you seen this?
No. Well, why don't you just describe overall what the bill does, and we've got, as I say, the fiscal note here, and we may have to do the same thing here, too, to...
Mr. Chair, I think we're going to have Ms. Fraser from the Secretary of State's office, who again prepared this thing.
Okay.
Come back up to the table, because this is truly the first I've seen this. So
sure. Okay. Ms. Fraser.
Working in the dark.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, there are two provisions in this bill, basically, that have a fiscal impact. The first has to do with a provision in the bill that broadens the scope of the lists that colleges may currently provide to the counties to be distributed to the polling places of students, so that students are able to go into the polling place and just show their student ID, and then the election judge looks them up in this college list, and then they're able to do same-day registration. This bill would broaden the scope of that list, so it's students who live both on and off campus in the city or county in which the institution is located. It would require the schools to send the information to the Secretary of State's office. We would sort it and send it to the counties, who would distribute it to the precincts. The other provision in the bill that has a fiscal note is that this bill eliminates the limit put in place a couple years ago on the number of people for whom a voter can vouch on election day. At that time, the limit was put in place at 15. Eliminating that limit would require us to make a few changes to the statewide voter registration system. And that cost is $3,000.
So out of the four sections, which are the ones that have fiscal impacts?
Section one is the college list.
Right.
It's over here. And section two is the deleting the limit on vouching.
Okay. So you're saying section three and section four do not have fiscal impacts?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Okay. I think what we'll do is just delete Section 1 and 2 from the bill here. I mean, the language will stay here for the moment. It can be included if that's a desire of the Budget Division. I mean, we'll probably lay the language over, but Senator Olsen moves to delete Section 1 and Section 2 from Senate File 954. So further discussion on that motion. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, motion prevails. The amendment is adopted.
Mr. Chair.
Maybe
it might be easier if we could just amend Sections 3 and 4 into the other bill, 1298.
If that's what you're...
Could we do that?
Mr. Chairman, and just I'm noticing in Section 3, there's a cross-reference to one of the changes, the section of law that's being amended in Section 2. I'm just not certain these can travel separately
okay. And
retain their meaning.
So I think we're going to have to send them separately, and then at the Finance Committee, maybe you can amend them into one bill there at that point, and then see what's happening in the other body, too, because they may be doing something different from what we're doing.
Okay.
Do you track what I'm saying? Okay. So Senator Olsen moves that Senate File 954 as amended recommended pass to the Finance Committee. Discussion on that motion. All those in favor?
Mr. Chair, did you take out the part now that had to do with how many people you can vouch for?
That's that's in this.
We removed Section 1 and 2 because those have fiscal impacts. We'll be just sending what's left of the bill, 3 and 4, which have no fiscal impact whatsoever, just to the Finance Committee. The language for 1 and 2 can stay here for possible inclusion. But as I say, the bill has partially fiscal impacts and partially not. So I'm just moving the bill out of here with a non-fiscal impact right now.
Well, I have a question about that.
Okay, sure. Which part is this, 3 or 4?
About removing the limit on the number of people you can vouch for. And I'm wondering what the intent here is. Are you going to bring busfuls of people to the polling sites and say, have somebody walk in and say, I know all of these people live in the district? Why would we want to remove a limit of 15?
Mr. Chair, Senator Roebling, Scott Cooper here representing the Minnesota Voting Rights Coalition, which is an alliance of nonprofit civic organizations that work on voter engagement, including the League of Women Voters, the Joint Religious Legislative Coalition, the Senior Federation, about 24 other groups. Our concern here is twofold. One is that we have had instances of people who did have personal knowledge, which is the requirement stated in law, of people's residence in a certain area, in a certain precinct, and could have vouched for them and could have vouched for more than 15 people. We had several incidences that came up in this last election where people were prohibited from doing that by the limit of 15, and we don't see any reason for it. The point of the vouching is that you have personal knowledge that someone lives in the same precinct as you, and you're vouching to the election judges that that is the case, but they ran up against the limit of 15. It seemed to be an unnecessary barrier to the election day registration of those people. The other reason we support this is that we've worked closely with local elections officials who have explained that this is a burden for the election judges. There are already many, many forms that they have to keep track of, and this is a new one that was just added a couple years ago where they have to keep a list of how many people each voucher vouches for, and that data is kept and nothing is really done with it, and they have said that it would save them money.
Okay. I got to back up for a second. Mr. Bonner has advised me that actually I misunderstood what was happening. Section 3 is actually interwoven into the previous section, so we cannot send this on its own and have it make any sense. So Senator Olsen moves that we reconsider the vote by which we deleted Sections 1 and 2. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, motion prevails. Okay, we have the bill back before us, 1 through 4. And Senator Higgins, it's all or nothing, basically, because it's all tied together. So.
Mr. Chair, why wouldn't Section 4 then be part of that as well?
It probably could, I guess, if you wanted to move that, do something. But I'm not sure whether there's much to do there in Section 4 without the first three sections. I guess that's your choice right now. We could send only Section 4 ahead, but Section 3 has to stay in if you get Section 2.
What do we think? Leave them all together?
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, let's leave them all together, please.
Okay. Are there any other questions on Senate File 954? Because there's a fiscal impact, as I say, we're going to have to. Senator Olsen moves that Senate File 954 be set aside for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. There's discussion on that motion. Hearing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, say no.
No.
Okay, the motion prevails. Ms. Fraser, are you able to advise us on Senate File 1298 yet? If not, we can go to Senator Ray, who's here. Or Senator Larson is a co-author of your bill, Senator Higgins, if you wanted to leave, and we could do it.
Since I have three more bills up in this time slot, I would sure appreciate that.
Well, okay, Senator Larson's a co-author. He'll be able to. Are you ready, Senator? Ms. Fraser, or we can
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Okay, which sections do not have a fiscal impact, or do either one? Just tell us which way you're going.
Well, there are only a few sections that do.
That do. Which ones are they?
They are 5.
5, okay.
8.
8.
9.
9.
21.
21.
22.
22.
45.
45.
And then Section 46 is the repealer. And one of the repealed sections goes with one of the sections that has a fiscal impact.
You said Section 45. I think it's 25 because it doesn't go that high.
The appropriation.
Oh, it does go to, I'm looking at the bill.
Mr. Chair.
I made the same mistake. Okay, I'm sorry. where are we? There, here we are. Yeah, okay, 45 is the appropriation. Okay. 45 and 46 is, okay.
And then 46 is the repealer, and the section 200.04 is the current Help America Vote Act complaint procedure that we're replacing in section 22. So we would need to keep that with section 22, that one repealer.
So on the repealer, you are trying to keep section, you do not want to repeal 200.04. Is that what you're saying?
I'm sorry, 200.04.
Yeah, you do not wish to repeal that.
We do wish to repeal it, Mr. Chair, but it needs to stay with section 22. Those two should travel together.
Okay.
200.04 provides the current procedure for complaints filed under the Help America Vote Act. Section 22 provides a whole new procedure. If we were to repeal this section without passing section 22,
okay.
Then...
Senator Rust.
So, Mr. Chairman, the motion is to delete the fiscal sections and leave them here?
Correct.
So, Mr. Chairman, I would move that we delete sections 5, 8, 9, 21, 22, 45, and on line, page 23, line 25, delete 200.04.
Does that work now? Okay. Okay. The motion of Senator Rest is to delete the sections of this bill that have fiscal impacts, and then the plan would be to move what's left forward. Okay, Mr. Lippman, you wish to testify on this. Okay.
Wouldn't mind, Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead. Welcome to the Budget Division. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. My name is Eric Lippman. I'm an administrative law judge with the Office of Administrative Hearings. The reason why I'm mindful of the motion that I asked to be recognized is that I would urge the committee also to think about Section 41. I had come to testify about that, or at least as to raise concerns, and if not wanting to interrupt the proceedings on the rest motions, at least what I had to say was relevant to what has a fiscal impact and what does not.
Do you believe, let's see.
Section 41 on page 21 of the subcommittee report?
It does look like it has a fiscal impact. It does.
And I can briefly detail for
sure.
The committee.
No. The only issue right now is I'm trying to segregate the fiscal stuff from the non-fiscal stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Once we've got the policy stuff away, there's no reason for us to look at that part of the bill and move the bill out of here. Then we will look at the fiscal issues. So,
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Rest.
Will we delete Section 41?
41 as well. Okay. Again, so 41 will stay here. Okay. So 5, 8, 9, 21, 22, 41, 45, and then part of 46. We're moving to delete those. So we will then, okay, on that motion, Senator Rest. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, motion prevails. Now, Senator Rest moves that Senate File 1.
1298.
As amended.
As amended, be recommended we pass and refer to the full committee on Friday.
And this means we're just forwarding a bill that has just policy in it right now. No, there's no reason for us to discuss the rest of that part of the bill. On that motion, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, motion prevails. So we do have the remaining portions that are still in the bill that are going to be retained in the committee. Mr. Lippman, if you wish to discuss Section 41, or if anybody else wants to discuss those, the remaining parts, 5, 8, 9, 21, 22, 41, 45, or 46, now is the appropriate time to do so.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, if you don't mind.
Go ahead.
Very much like to.
Yes.
Pointing members' attention to page 21 of the committee report, the language would be in the amended subdivision 2, which is on that portion of section 41, which appears on page 21, would refer to the Office of Administrative Hearings, as is in the current law, cases relating to the non-filing by local candidates and local candidate committees of the financial reports which are due under Chapter 211A. So your school district candidate has campaign finance filing that they must do with the local school district clerk. The candidate doesn't do that. There is a procedure under current law for them to be assessed a fine for not proceeding with that. The amendments that occur on page 21 of the committee report would change the financing for how those cases are resolved. Under the current law, as you can tell from the deleted section, the filing officer files a complaint under 211B.32, and under, like other campaign cases, those charges are cost are sent incurred against the county from which the filing officer resides. And so, again, if you had a local St. Paul a school district candidate that didn't file, presumably the school district clerk of St. Paul would send file a complaint with the Office of Administrative Hearings, but Ramsey County would get that that bill for that case. That was certainly the underlying intention when this work was referred to the Office of Administrative Hearings. I've been working with Mr. Mansky of Ramsey County Elections and the kind folks at the Secretary of State's office, Ms. Frazier as Director of Intergovernmental Relations, and others. Our concern is that if you have a 211B32 process and don't charge the counties, and as this language would suggest, make the Office of Administrative Hearings compensate the judge's time or account for the judge's time solely on the basis of the fine revenue, that the fine revenue that you could get from not filing your paperwork on time is not going to be sufficient enough to pay for the cost of, under 211B32, a three-judge panel. There may well be other quicker, cheaper processes, but as written, we are going to be quickly running over the amount of fine revenue in fairly short order. Now, I know from the county's point of view, they, as they're not a party, in my example, to either the school district candidate not filing or even the city of St. Paul's bills, they find it objectionable to end up with that invoice. And there may well be other ways to solve that. I just highlight that concern because, as written, either that cost is going to reside with the Office of Administrative Hearings and our revolving fund, or presumably it's going to be taxed to other agencies that rely upon our services. The Department of Administration has a dispute that we resolve, and if we can't pay for the school district clerk's non-filing, Commissioner Badgerow, just by way of example, as she's here in the audience, and her department pay for some of that cost. That doesn't seem particularly fair and seems counter to the intentions of this committee and the legislature generally on how the revolving fund works. So I just highlight those concerns only because the res, as to which we're supposed to charge against, seems fairly small compared to the bills that we might incur under the current process. That can all be changed, it can be adjusted, it can be downsized, but we wanted to highlight that concern and invite the various stakeholders who'd like to change the current rules to work with us so that we can have something that makes sense and works for all parties. With that, I'm grateful for the committee's time.
Thank you. Any questions? Okay, is there anybody else, any other questions on the sections that are still before us? Okay. We're going to have to, again, we'll lay this over for possible consideration of the omnibus bill. So Sarah Olsen moves at sections 5, 8, 9, 21, 22, 41, 45, and the remaining part of section 46, the appealer, be set aside for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Discussion on that motion. Hearing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, say no. Motion prevails. Okay, thank you, Will Senator Larson, for presenting, staying for Senator Higgins. Senator Torres Ray, we have Senate File 1346, Secretary of State Registrations Filing and Dissolution of Entity Provisions. Senator Torres Ray, welcome to the Budget Division.
Mr. Chair, and thank you, members of the committee, for giving me my first opportunity to speak before your committee.
And this is a housekeeping bill, and I guess we have to identify what portions are the budget issues. Is anybody, I guess, is enough to, Mr. Black, would you be able to identify which parts of the budget issues here?
Yes, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Bert Black. I'm the legal advisor for the Office of the Secretary of State. And you are now receiving a, I apologize because this is a document prepared for the other body.
Okay,
but
well,
it's the same bill.
I'll deal with it. Okay.
And on page 2 of that, we do indicate which sections. There are five sections of the bill. There's about 20 sections in this bill in two articles. There are five sections in the first article that have fiscal implications. And if you like, I can...
Could you just identify which sections of this bill have fiscal implications? I think what we may need to do is just segregate those out
right
now to move the bill ahead.
Those would be sections 1,
okay.
2, 10, 12, and 14.
Okay.
1, 2, 10, 12, 14.
Well,
and the Powerball is 36.
Okay. Yeah, thank you. Now, actually, are these just raising fees? So this would not kind of get...
We have some that raise fees, we have some that lower fees, and we have one that simply indicates where a fee is to be used.
Okay.
So numbers 1, let's see, 1 and 14 raise fees, number 10 actually reduces a fee, Section 2 has a savings, and Section 12 is directory in terms of where the fee goes.
Now, members, this bill could travel on its own because it doesn't really affect the budget targets at all. It's just raising and changing fees within the Secretary of State's office. It doesn't really affect any other things that we're doing here. So, Mr. Black, you know, could you just, again, you've identified those sections. Could you just briefly describe what you're doing, and then we'll just see if there's any questions here.
Yes. Section 1, we have a standard copy fee of $3 for the initial documents like Articles of Incorporation and $3 for the amendments that come, no matter how many amendments there are. As you might imagine, Target Corporation has a lot of amendments. Assumed names are different than that. For some reason, assumed names are $3 for the whole thing. And while we get very few transactions, we get 600 of those transactions a year, and so the amount of money is only $1,800 a year. Frankly, it costs more than that. We're coming up against a computer rewrite. It's going to cost a lot more than that to write the program to have a different copy fee. So that's why this is included in there. Section 2 deals with business corporations. Right now we have a notice before the dissolution and a notice after the dissolution. This is to eliminate the notice after the dissolution, since they've all gotten the notice that if they fail to file, they are going to be dissolved. And that's going to save $4,000 a year in printing and postage. Section 10 relates to limited partnerships. The limited partnership law was amended not too many. It was actually recodified, a whole new limited partnership law not very long ago. And we're just finding some bugs in there. We don't charge for the annual report, and we want to make sure that it's understood that in the language that there is no fee for the annual report. So we're clarifying that and reducing the non-Minnesota name reservation fee from $50 to $35. We get maybe 200 filings a year for name reservations from limited partnerships because they can all file name reservations under the corporate law, which is $35. So we get very little business along this line, and so this would be a decrease to the general fund of about $3,000. Section 12, let me do Section 14 first because it'll make more sense that way. Section 14 is with respect to UCC fees. Before 2004, you may remember, some of you may remember that in 2000 we amended, recodified Article 9, secured financing in the Uniform Commercial Code. We had a $20 fee at that time. Everything was filed on paper at that time. In 2004, we were able to implement online filings. The legislature put in a discount in the online filing fee of $5 down to $15 for online filings. The Secretary of State's office does paper filings, but mostly online filings. The online filings come to our website. We also have counties who are satellite offices. Out in the counties, they do only paper. So their fee that they were statutorily required to charge, even though they kept the fee, it was a higher fee. It was $20. We were charging $15 for online. The counties, frankly, have There have been some issues there. There's been some confusion with customers. Is it 20? Is it 15? You know, it depends on how you're filing, but not all the customers have always understood that. The counties, in some respect, have felt that we're undercutting them, that we're being a competitor to them. And so what we are doing with this section is we are making all the filing fees the same again, $20. At the same time as we have this $20 fee, we also have a looming problem. And the looming problem is that we're about to go to a system with respect to both our online UCC filings and other filings, where we're going to be required to pay remote payment transaction fees because we're going to be going towards e-check and credit card. We currently do not offer credit card for the UCC online. So when you have credit cards, you're required to pay the credit card organizations a fee. Now, of course, that's a fee that we would have to charge on top of what's required to be turned over to the general fund. And frankly, with $24 million a biennium in transactions on the business side of the house at the usual 3%, if we go to our ultimate goal of having all these transactions, or as many as possible, be online, that quickly becomes a lot of money. And so our thinking is that since we have this situation where the counties would like us to have equal fees, that money, as it turns out, is about a wash with the amount of credit card fee that we would have to pay. And it will save our customers from having to pay what we calculate to be an additional $3 per transaction. So the bottom line is, if we can use this money, put it into our Uniform Commercial Code account, which we've had for many years, and that is what Section 12 is all about, is directing us to use the Uniform Commercial Code account in addition to the current authorized purposes for the purposes of paying remote transaction fees and improving the online services. If we are able to do that, we can make the retail price of this just $20 instead of $23 for our online customers. We've contacted the folks in the business law section. I've had some good feedback on this. They think the idea of devoting, if we're going to raise the fee, use the money for paying the credit card fee. So, Mr. Chair and members, those are the fiscal portions of this bill.
Okay, are there any questions on this? Anybody else who wants to be heard on it? Okay, is there a motion? Well, I think this bill could go to the Finance Committee then. It doesn't need to be in the omnibus bill. So, Senator Ryan.
I move that Senate File 1346 be recommended for us to refer to the Finance Committee.
On that motion, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, say no. Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Torres-Ray.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is the easiest thing I've done so far.
Well,
I didn't even have to introduce the bill, so thank you so much.
Well, we're glad to accommodate.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Larson, did you want to take up, and while you're taking, going to the witness table, we do have the A2 amendment. Could you give that to Senator Larson? The A2 amendment on Senate File 131. As I say, this was a study after it came out of the Policy Committee last week. There were some other individuals who had an interest in being part of the study group to study the preservation of documents. I believe that everybody is on board with the A2 amendment. If not, I need to know right now. I see some heads nodding, so I will move the A2 amendment. And as I say, this just adds some more people to the study of the electronic data.
Okay.
Mr. Butter.
Mr. Chairman, I did want to point out, if you're trying to engross the amendment, the amendment is actually done to the first engrossment of Senate File 131.
Which you don't
so
have.
It's online now, and that's what I used, but it should work.
Okay.
With that, is there any other discussion on the amendment? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
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 Oops, opposed.
You got
same sign.
Too.
Motion carries.
And, Mr. Chair, then I'll move it. As I say, I don't believe there's a fiscal cost to this, but if there turns out to be, I'm just going to have to deal with that and possibly even consider removing it from the bill, but I don't think that this is a cost. I'll move that the contents of Senate File 131 as amended be included in the omnibus bill.
Okay. All those, is there any other discussion on this? All those in favor of moving 131 into the omnibus bill, signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries. Oh,
there you go.
Official.
Yeah, no. Okay. That makes it official. Okay. Senator Larson, Senate File 1527, non-binding presidential primary establishment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate File 1527 establishes a non-binding presidential primary in Minnesota that would take place the first Tuesday after the first Monday in February, beginning in the 2008 presidential election. And members, the bill largely, as it relates to the policy, are the changes that are necessary to carry out the election in terms of the Secretary of State's application of filing and dates, fees, things of that nature. The fiscal impact is Section 8 of the bill, which requires the Secretary of State to reimburse counties and municipalities for their expenses so that the state bears the cost of the presidential primary. Mr. Chair, I do not have a fiscal note. Informally, we've had many discussions about the cost, which is somewhat significant, probably in the area of $5 million. And Mr. Chair, this is an effort to move Minnesota up with the other states that are considering moving up their primaries to have a voice in the presidential election and the selection of our next president. And so I bring this to you with that in mind, also understanding that the cost is significant.
There's no money. Okay. Any questions? Senator Rust.
Mr. Chairman, in light of our discussion the other day, we do get opportunity to recommend to the Finance Committee the expenses for
one-time money. That's correct.
One-time money. Yes. So who knows what the Finance Committee is going to do? So it's not as if it's just totally la la land here. I mean, that might end up being a priority somewhere along the line.
Well, thank you. Mr. Chair and Senator Rest, I agree with you completely, and I think this is an excellent candidate for one-time money. I've been handed a note by the Secretary of State's office that actually better estimates the cost of the bill to be more closer to $3.5 million. So we've already reduced the cost to here in the meeting, Mr. Chair.
Sure.
Roughly $1 million to the Secretary of State, and the $2.5 million that we would be reimbursed to local units of government. You know, this there is I know also discussion as it relates to you know, a primary that is non-binding. On the other hand, I know that concern has been raised by some members. I would say that our participation in our national elections is important. I view this as a step toward greater participation from Minnesota's perspective as we see reform occur across the nation in the selection of our president. I believe in 2008 we will see a process play out that's far different from anything that we've seen, at least in our recent history, where many states are trying to move forward and have a louder voice in the selection process rather than a couple of states completely leading that effort off. And so I'm hopeful that we can at least keep this discussion moving and think that a presidential primary occurring here in February of 2008 with candidates bringing essentially that discussion to Minnesota and bringing those campaigns and those candidates to Minnesota for our voters to consider and to have a better chance to know the candidates. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any questions? Sarah Robley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And you know from our discussion on Friday that I kind of think a non-binding presidential primary is rather frivolous, and that it really doesn't hold any water as far as the commitment of delegates when they go to the national conventions to actually do endorsements. And I guess I understand that we're going to kind of get caught up in it, but I hate to see us paying for it. And, you know, $3 to $6 million is no small amount of change. And I guess I'm just thinking that the timing is so early, too, in Minnesota to have a February primary, presidential primary, when candidates would be here in December and January trying to campaign. I know they campaign at a different level than we do. They don't go door to door like legislative candidates do. But I still question the wisdom of such an early date and extending the presidential campaigns even longer than they are already. It just doesn't make sense to me, and I haven't found any support in my heart for it.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Roebling. I do know that from our previous conversation. I would say, though, that we have very little control over the timing. It's clear that the timeline is being moved up nationally and by other states that are desiring to also have their voice heard. And so the one thing I think I'd prefer not to have happen is that Minnesota not have a voice in the choice of our next president. I think it would be unfortunate if Minnesotans weren't able to participate in that, and by the time our process rolled around, the nominees were already chosen. And there's at least some school of thought that in starting in 2008, that will largely be the case. There is an effort, I know, nationally to move to a regional primary system where we would have four regional primary dates that would rotate on different presidential elections. But that's something that's far away from today. And we have the current landscape to deal with, and this is at least, I think, a modest attempt to involve Minnesotans in the presidential process and allow Minnesotans to state their preference on who they would like to be the nominee. And we do it in a way, actually, that's and for committee members that were not in the state and local government committee, so that you know this about this bill. This is a little bit different from the 92. Primary where you actually had to declare and ask for a ballot of the Democratic Party or the Republican Party, and then you would be recorded as having selected that ballot, and we're on the voter file as someone who voted in the Republican primary, for example. That is not in this bill. We've chosen not to have that provision in this bill, moving away from, if you will, a party registration as it relates to the presidential primary.
Further discussion? Okay, hearing none, then Senator Larson moves it. Senator Larson moves that Senate File 1527 be set aside for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Further discussion? Hearing none. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, say no.
No.
Motion prevails. Okay, folks, we are done with the bills. Now we have to start talking about the budget, and we'll do that. We've got a little bit of time left, but we are going to I'll lay out what we've got right now, and then we will have to have some decisions made and do that today, and we'll finish her off on Wednesday. Hand this one out right now. Okay. What we're handing her out right now, I'll go through it, but the very first thing we need to do is adopt a motion to have a motion to adopt the base funding. Now, we have not at any point made any proposals to dig into the base to discontinue anything that we're currently doing. So if there's a will of the Budget Division, we can do that. But I haven't sensed any desire to do any of that yet. So is there a motion, first of all, to adopt the base funding for the fiscal years for 08 and 09 and then 10 and 11? Again, that just adopts the base of the agencies that we have oversight over. And as you can see, we've got about for 08, 09, 549, 122, and then 10 and 11, 551.010. We're not cutting anything, but we're just adopting what the agencies are doing at the moment. Is there, Senator West?
I'd make that motion, and I have some questions.
Yeah, and then we'll be, but all we're doing is adopting the base right now. On that motion, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, motion prevails. Now, let me explain what the rest of this page does, and certainly Mr. Lundeen, I'll need your. We have assigned to us a target of a $10 million cut, and that's the second to the last line on the bottom. So if all we had was the base and a $10 million cut, we'd have to cut part of the base to get there. However, we did have the Department of Revenue saying that if they were given about $10 million in 08, 09, $11 million in 10, 11, they could hire people to do tax compliance, that is, go after people that have not paid their taxes. Now, they've already done some of that. They've gotten the low-hanging fruit already. This is the more hardcore people who have not paid taxes, but they believe, and here's where you go about the middle of the page, if you spend that money for tax compliance, they would get about $51 million, $51,200 in 08, 09, $60 in 10 and 11. Now, of course, you'd say, well, geez, why don't we spend more and get more? It doesn't quite work that way because you can't hire that many people. Plus, it gets harder and harder to squeeze out the money then. But their numbers tell us that by spending the tax compliance spending money, we will get the revenue money, and that will bring us out of the red and into the black, okay? So, and then, now, that's one spending thing. The other thing, the governor has proposed 2% salary supplements. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean pay increases. It could mean that money is going for health care benefits, so people might get the same pay, but they're taking home a little bit more because they're not spending as much on the health. So what this proposes to do is to spend money for tax compliance and for compensation and capture the revenue for tax compliance, which would, and with the target we're given, would give us $4,839 in 08, $5,865 in 09, for a total of $10 million at 704 in 08, 09, and then you can see that what it would do it for 10 and 11. That is what's suggested. Now, you know, this budget division can suggest and say, well, we'll stick with the governor's recommendations of 2% and 2%. We could do that, but we're not operating, as I said before, in a vacuum. I mean, there's other budget divisions that are looking at the very same compensation issue, and the Finance Committee is setting a target of 3.25 for each year. So if we do 2%, that number is probably going to change to 3.25 in the Finance Committee. It might change, you know, it could change the floor too. I mean, the Senate can do what the Senate wills, but at least this is what's consistent, what is happening in other budget divisions. So, Mr. Lundeen, could you explain anything further?
This is the permanent money.
This is permanent ongoing money. We're not dealing with one-time money yet. We'll do that in a minute. This is the ongoing money for starting next July 1st. Mr. Lundeen.
Yeah, I think the only thing that I would add is the governor did tell agencies to plan for the 3.25% in their budgets but provided them with 2%. So what this is doing is providing the entire 3.25% in new money rather than having to find some of the money within their base.
Now, if you wish to adopt what we have before us, again, what that would do is spend some money for tax compliance. We would get some money for tax compliance, and it would also adopt the 3.25 compensation rate, and then it would give us some money. No decisions are made what we're going to do with the bottom line money. This only gets us some bottom line money. Senator Jungbauer.
Mr. Chair, I asked about getting a copy of that graph, the exponential growth and decay curve. I guess I'm a little uncomfortable. I want to see that they have something graphed out that shows that we're on a smooth line on this compliance, that the more money we spend, something where we can show the past history and show that we're on the right thing before I feel comfortable with.
I can only operate with the number that revenue has given us, and this is the governor's recommendation. This is what the governor, this is part of his budget proposal to us. I did meet with a revenue commissioner who said, you know, you can't add more money and get lots more money because right. When they started doing this for spending a buck, you could get 10. They're now down to spending a dollar, you can get 6 or 7. It's going to get to, because now you're getting more and more hardcore folks. And there is a point of diminishing returns where you just, you know, can spend all the money you want. There's certain tax dollars you're never going to collect. But this is what the governors and the administration tell us is available for tax compliance. Senator Jungbauer.
Mr. Chair, I'm just one of those weird people. You can tell me something all day long, but I like to see it, and I like to see they've got to have it graphed out. They've got to be able to show us what they've spent and what they've done. And, you know, I guess I asked for it.
Mr. Lindane, yeah, can you elaborate?
Yes, Senator. I did talk to the Department of Finance, one of the EBOs that's responsible for the Department of Revenue budget, and did pass along your request. And so hopefully you will be either getting something from the Department of Finance or the Department of Revenue.
Thank you, and I hope so. I mean, it should be something that's well documented, or they wouldn't give us these numbers. So it should have been that easy that they could have just forwarded.
Well, I suspect there's more numbers hidden out there too, and I can only deal with the ones that they've given to me, you know, one way or the other. So, but I there's no trickery here. There's, you know, these are the honest numbers that I was able to pull together with professionals. So, Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering about the 3.25% compensation increase, and you indicated that the Finance Committee had decided that that would probably be the rate that would be used throughout all of state government agencies. Is
I
that
believe,
correct?
Yeah, everybody, because we can't do 2% here and have some other budget division do 4% and have somebody else do 9%. I mean, it's all got to be the same. So, you know, as I said, we're not operating on our own on this one. It's, you know, everybody's going to wind up with the same 3.25%, at least at the Finance Committee level.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Senator Roebling.
Well, it does concern me that it's 1.25% over the governor's recommendation. Yeah. And you can see in the out years that it adds up a lot and quickly when we add that much to it. And, of course, we have to watch our tails as well. But I'm trying to understand how did the Senate Finance Committee decide on 3.25%? Do they have a certain calculation, for example, for the health care premium increases, and then using the CPI, which is about 2% across the board? What were they using?
And it wasn't the Finance Committee meeting to do that. I guess Mr. Melendine can explain, because it's where the fiscal folks came on this one?
Yeah, where the 3.25% came from is this is what the governor in his budget told agencies to plan for in their budgets. And in the general fund budgets and some of the other that we directly appropriate, the governor provided 2%, knowing that that remaining amount that they would have to find within their existing budgets. So what the recommendation here, coming down with these targets, was to fully fund the 3.25% rather than asking agencies to dig into their base to try and find the other dollars. And that's based on looking at, you know, the salary costs that are coming up, the health insurance costs, which I think are for the next fiscal year about 10%. And so those all went into that calculation of the 3.25%.
Any further discussion? Is there a motion to adopt the general fund budget that we have before us? Okay, Senator Rust has moved to adopt the general fund. We adopted the base, but this is now the rest of it. All those in favor of adopting this as our fund budget, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Those opposed say no.
No.
Motion prevails. Now, which one is that? This?
I don't have it written.
Okay. If you could pass this up. There is a non-general fund base. This does not cost us anything. This has been passed out. It says Senate State Government Budget, non-general fund above the base. And who can, Mr. Lindane, can you describe what this is?
Yeah, there are some of the agencies under this jurisdiction that get funding from other funds rather than the general fund. And I guess I didn't write it down on the sheet, but we would also have to adopt the base budgets for those agencies. That would be such as the Minnesota Racing Commission is paid for out of a special revenue appropriation. The Lawful Gambling Control Board is paid for out of a special revenue appropriation that we need to directly appropriate. There's some appropriations to the Department of Revenue out of the Environmental Fund, the Remediation Fund, and the Healthcare Access Fund, and the Highway User Fund that covers their costs of collecting these taxes. And there's also an appropriation to the administrative hearings for the workers' comp judges, which comes out of the workers' comp special payment fund. So we would need to make a motion here to adopt the base budget for for those agencies.
And this doesn't come out of our targets or anything. These are things that I believe they're covered in the governor's budget proposal.
Yes, this would be just the base.
The governor's already covered this, so Senator Rest.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Lundeen, is that the whole list?
That would be, let me just look, I'll go through real quickly and I'll let you know. In the legislature, there's a small appropriation from the Healthcare Access Fund. The Attorney General has appropriations out of the State Government Special Revenue Fund, and this would basically be coming from the medical boards and that paying their legal costs where the AG represents them. There's a small appropriation out of the Environmental Fund. I did mention administrative hearings.
Is that the third meeting of this list?
No, I have a different spreadsheet that hasn't been handed out. That spreadsheet is just of requests above the base that the committee has received. Yeah, I don't know if we have copies here today. We've passed it out in the past, but we can certainly get you copies of the base. Let's see, and then I did mention the Department of Revenue from those three non-general funds. And then the other would be in the contingent accounts fund. There's a small appropriation out of the State Government Special Revenue Fund and a small appropriation out of the Workers' Comp Fund.
Are those base or above base?
Those would be just the base appropriations.
Okay. So they're already included. We've already done that. These are the only ones that are above the base, but again, they don't
from
different funds that do not come out of the general fund, correct? So the ones he's just read before are base ones, which we don't have to deal with.
I move.
Okay, Senator Rest moves that the state government budget non-general fund above base list be adopted. Further discussion on that motion. Hearing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, motion prevails. So, Mr. Bodern, do you have enough to start working on to prepare a base bill with what we've got here?
Mr. Chairman, yes.
Okay. Could we hand out this one here? Okay. Now, we got two more things to deal with, the one-time money and the ongoing money. Now, I sat down and I made up a list what I could figure out, what can I do with the limited dollars that we've got as ongoing money. This is an idea, my thoughts, my recommendations. We've got plenty of... We got between now and Wednesday to work it out. Now you've got the list that you had today, and that this shows every change item that was made by the governor on the first page, 2.5 pages, I guess page and a half, and then there are lists from other folks. We've had bills to show other things that other people would like to do, and I think Mr. Lundeen said the other day, being about $300 million, $309 million. In order to do all this other stuff, including the capital renovation, which is $130 million, okay. Given the fact we've got $5 million in 1 year and $5 million the next year, I guess, roughly, we're not going to get $309 million out of this. I've made a list, and it's kind of the top part's what we've already done. If you start looking about the middle of the page, here's some ideas that I've got. The Senate technology is way behind, and you can see it as recently as the floor this morning where they can't bring up amendments and so forth. Our board is a couple of decades old. Anyway, you've heard the presentation. The Senate actually made a request for about $9 million. They said, well, we can get by with $6 million. This only gives them $3 million, but that's an idea. Capital Architectural Board has been working Legislative Auditor. Senator Rest had a bill where the auditor would be able to keep the money for four agencies that they are paying in general fund. Rather than doing that, this just pulls the money out of the general fund and gives it to the legislative auditor because, frankly,
For
the independence of the auditor, right. Capital Area Architectural Planning Board has been operating part-time. This puts them back to full-time. LIMIC, you've heard a lot about that. This is the money that they've asked for. The census. We have a census coming on up. We have to fund that. And, frankly, we're at risk of losing one of our congressional seats. So I adopted the Department of Administration census figures. We gained some money by the Department of Employee Relations merger. Now, I think there's more money to be gained right now, but we've only been told that there's one position that's going to be eliminated, and that's been reflected here. Operations of an Enterprise Technology says they need $7 million a year alone for computer security. I haven't been able to come up with $7 million. I put, you know, about half of it in here for each one of those 2 years. The state auditor needs some money to retain the state auditor's staff, and that this is reflected here. There's some money that we get from pension aids and pension fees. Mr. Lindeen, maybe can describe. Could you describe that a little bit more detail?
Yeah, the bottom half of this sheet where it's talking about the state auditor is just giving some more explanation. As you recall, the state auditor was in here and it asked for some additional funding for staff retention for her audit staff. And the way her budget works is she gets audit fees and there's some deduction of pension aid that goes back to the general fund. So what I'm showing here is kind of the net cost of her request. The total request coming there, this is including the compensation, the 3.25%, and then the individual audit recommendation that she brought forward to us would be $751,000 in fiscal year 8 and $778,000 in fiscal year 9 for a total of slightly more than $1.5 million for the biennium. Now, when you take into account those offsetting revenues that are coming in non-dedicated to the general fund from the audit fees that are charged out and from the deduction to the state pension aids, that comes to a total for the biennium of $1.2 million. And so the net cost against our target for her request would be $310,000 for the biennium.
So it's another spend some, but we get some in here, too, to make it happen. These are my ideas. As I say, we're going to open it up on Wednesday to see what your thoughts are and so forth, but this is how I got to what we got within the targets, and, of course, there's plenty of other priorities and other things people want to do. Can we get the one-time list handed out now because we're about to? The other day I said we would have a list of one-time things, and we had to make just a quick written amendment right now to include Senator Larson's presidential primary on here because that was not on the list. But there's a number of proposals on one-time money, and the guidance I right now have from the Finance Committee is that initially they were thinking about having about $16 million in one-time money for state government operations, which is obviously more than ongoing money we've got here. We've heard a number of proposals in here. We're just about out of – this is the list. And Mr. Lundeen, might, if you want to go down quickly down the list and kind of explain what I'd like to have everybody do, and since some people aren't here, we'll have to get them the list. We're going to get a list to everybody. I need to have you sign your name on them and then rank them 1 through 10. There's a ranking column. And we're going to just total them up. Obviously, if we just sat here and did all the small ones, we could get to $16 million. If we did two or three big ones, we could get to $16 million. I don't know what our priorities are.
And this is
$16 million is what it appears they want me to do a bill. Now, if you want, we can put together the in fact, I've already told Senator Cohen, I said we may just be putting the capital restoration in here. Now, I think he can get by with that with $20 million, but that's more than what what we've got targeted. But if we want to do capital restoration and send it to the Finance Committee, we've already sent the bill there, that's a possibility. But this is everything.
Mr. Still, Chair?
Yeah.
I'm sorry. Senator Rust.
I have a question back on this.
Okay. Let me back up. Okay.
I just wanted to make sure I understand how this goes. For example, on the you're recommending that the capital area – the cap board's $62 million.
Yes.
And so I go back here and track this to $62 million. But the compensation adjustment we had already adopted in the base with the 3.25.
Yes.
So that's why we don't have to deal
right.
with that line on any of the stuff that's on here. That's
wherever it says
is
compensation adjustment, we've
we
done
already
that.
Adopted that.
We've done that.
Okay.
Yes.
Just want to make sure.
Yes.
Sure.
Thank you, Senator. Senator Kubley.
I guess, you know, so when we're going through this list, are we asked to limit our what we're doing to $16 million?
No. You just rank them.
So then can we recommend an item that's on the list for less than it's on there for, or for do we just recommend the item?
Just recommend the item, because if you're trying to put less than it's going to cause some problems. somehow we'll make it. We'll get some items on here. We'll get to 16. But every if you rank them 1 through 10, there's more than 10 on here. But we're going to come back on Wednesday, and we'll have a sense of where this budget division, where our priorities are. And at some point, we're going to draw the line and say, you know, that's where we get to 16. Now, some items, we might have to make some adjustments to get to 16. So you right now don't worry about changing the numbers. But I will tell you, for the middle of Center File 666 capital renovation, $132 million, that might be able to be done with $20 million, but even that is way over it. So don't worry about that number.
It's actually a little bit more than 20.
Yeah, whatever. But don't worry about the numbers. Rank them. Just 1 through 10, and then we'll assign values to each one, and then we're going to come back in on Wednesday, and you're going to see where this budget division wants its priorities to get to $16 million.
Mr. Chair, when do we need these turned into you?
Sometime tomorrow.
If you can,
by 3 o'clock tomorrow. Okay, and we're going to track down the members who are not here right now and go through. Does anybody have any questions about the items that are on this? Because you may not remember anything in particular. Do you want to be refreshed in your memory what any of these one-time items are?
Well, Mr. Chair,
Senator Roebling.
I was just going to go back to the other budget where we did Senate Technology. So are you splitting it up here so that part of it would be in ongoing funding?
No. Everything here on this page is ongoing. Everything is ongoing. We're also going to do a separate bill for one-time money, and that's for the current biennium that ends next June 30th. It appears we've got the Senate Finance Committee is going to assign $16 million to this budget division on one-time money, and that is why I want to get your preferences here. The other one, and we'll have to make this decision on Wednesday, what do you want to do with the $4.8 million in 08 and $5.8 million in 09 for ongoing? Not one-time money. This is ongoing. I've made a list of how you can get there. But that's just my idea. I want to hear what you want to think, and we'll hear that on Wednesday. Whatever it is, we're stuck with these numbers. Is there a rest?
Before, we were talking about just sending, on the one-time money, the Finance Committee a list.
There was an email Friday afternoon where they sent it out to us, and it said that...
I saw that.
Yeah, and I think, frankly, it'd be chaotic if the Finance Committee just had every budget division sending a list in and let the Finance Committee do it.
Had a saner view prevail.
So they decided that they would assign one time... I don't know. They don't want to use the word targets, but they basically said that this division... Can send me something that totals $16 million.
But in bill language,
in the list. Yeah. And what's likely to happen is that a bill would be prepared based upon a one-time money bill, based upon our priorities. I believe we'll prepare it. I'll introduce it if anybody wants to sign up on a co-author. I'll take co-authors. I'll introduce it, and that bill will go to the Finance Committee. We'll then introduce a second bill with the ongoing money. That bill will also go to the Finance Committee, and then the Finance Committee will do what the Finance Committee does. So two bills, one bill of approximately $16 million of one-time money. If we want to put capital restoration in there, we can do that. And one bill of ongoing money.
So you put the two bills in with money above the base and with the one-time money.
Mm-hmm.
You get introduced to the Finance Committee.
Mm-hmm.
And then they send that back down to us?
No. The bills would stay in the Finance Committee.
And so there would be three... Eventually, there would be our base funding bill, which we already just passed here. And additions to the ongoing would not be part of that funding bill. Is that correct?
I don't know. Mr. Bodder, no. No.
Mr. Chairman, I think the easiest thing to do would be to combine the continuing budget additions with the base bill, and that would be introduced. And then you may want to inquire further about the second bill. I think you might want to put the one-time language in a reviser document format, but perhaps not introduce it.
Okay. I'll rely upon counsel to tell me how, the mechanics of how we're going to get
because
there.
I'm just wondering whether there's going to be one Senate state government finance bill, regardless of where the agreement comes, that where we would carry the ongoing, the increase to the ongoing, and some amount of one-time money.
It is my understanding, and this may be changing, but it's my understanding that there may be one bill for one-time money.
Okay.
And all the budget if that's the way they go, then all the budget divisions will have something in there. So the bill that we would send then would stay in finance and never come out, but there would be a one-time money bill coming out. But then there would also be a state government budget bill coming out with the base funding and whatever new additions that we agree to. Are we there? Do I understand it? Okay. Any questions on the process? We have to finish this on Wednesday, so no bills. We'll just Ms. Fraser.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Neither of the lists seem to include any of the bills that were heard by the committee today.
That's right. I knew they were coming. Were there any one-time money lists? I just added the primary ones. Until we get the fiscal, well, first of all, you know, we may have no decisions are being made right now.
Okay.
But the long list is only the one-time money items. If it's not one-time money, that's not going to be on this ranking list. The other thing is the ongoing money. And I got roughly $5 million in each year to deal with. And I've heard plenty of proposals that exceed $5 million, you know, so. We're all going to get lobbied in the next 2 days, folks. But, you know, I mean, if you don't like my list, you can take anything out but and put something else in. But any questions? Okay. Thanks for sticking around. Meeting is adjourned.